Good morning. The Department of the Interior is reestablishing a formal government-to-government relationship with the Native Hawaiian community. UH Professor Daviana McGregor weighs in on what it all means. A longtime Hollywood writer looks at cultural appropriation in the wake of Disney's Halloween costume controversy. And the DLNR's Aquatic Resources Division looks at wastewater issues in West Hawaii. I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
I'm Bill Sage. Most Americans know about the December 7th Pearl Harbor attack, but a lot happened in 1941 before the Day of Infamy. We'll speak with author Mark Wortman. And remembering Hawaii's brilliant comedian Rap Replinger. Remembering Rap with biographer Lisa Clark Stone.
It's Friday, September 23rd, and the conversation starts right after the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook.
Aloha kakahiaka, Chris. Pehea oi. Moka aloha Friday.
Very busy Aloha Friday today. An announcement released overnight by the U.S. Department of the Interior establishes a framework for Native Hawaiian self-determination. U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell says in the statement, "Today is a major step forward in the reconciliation process between Native Hawaiians in the United States that began over 20 years ago. We're proud to announce this final rule that respects and supports self-governance for Native Hawaiians, one of our nation's largest indigenous communities." Dr. Daviana Pōmaikaʻi McGregor, professor and founding member of the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of Hawaii Manoa, is on hand to tell us what it all means. Good morning, Daviana.
Good morning. Aloha kakahiaka.
And saying you're going to tell us what it all means is a fairly tall order, isn't it?
Yes. It's something we've been working on since the apology law was passed in 1993, mm-hmm. and working for a pathway for Native Hawaiians to establish our own form of self-governance and reestablish this relationship with the U.S. government.
What are the elements required for the establishment of such a form of self-governance?
I'm sorry.
You have a constitution.
That's right.
Being one element, right?
Yeah. The main thing is to have a constitution that is ratified by the Native Hawaiian people. The rule sets a threshold of between 30,000 to 50,000 Hawaiians ratifying the constitution, of which at least 9,000 need to be beneficiaries of the Hawaiian Homes Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Once that government is reestablished, it'll be up to that government to decide if it wants to go on this pathway to reestablish a government-to-government relationship. It wouldn't be automatic. But up until this time, there has not been a pathway for Native Hawaiians to seek to reestablish this relationship with the U.S. government. There's been a pathway for the Native American tribes within the 48 contiguous states, and there's a pathway for Native Alaskans, mm-hmm. Under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. But this is the first time that's there now a pathway for Native Hawaiians.
What was different? What is different, or what was different about the Native Hawaiian and Alaskan understandings that the Hawaiians didn't have? The recognition as an entity, as a government?
No, the recognition as a government, I would say comes with federal legislation since 1900s that recognized Native Hawaiians as an indigenous people, as a people who had a nation formed before the formation of the U.S. nation itself.
Mm-hmm.
And with the 1993 apology law, that was the clearest recognition acknowledgement by the U.S. government of our standing as a Native Hawaiian nation.
When the secretary said it's been more than 20 years, is that process what started with the apology?
Yes, there was a process that then... It called for a process of reconciliation, mm-hmm. between the U.S. government and the Native Hawaiian people. And And so, and then it wasn't until 2000, after the Rice versus Caetano decision was made by the U.S. Supreme Court, that there was an effort to by the U.S. government to really establish a pathway for Native Hawaiians to have self-governance. And mm-hmm. that was through the Akaka Bill that was introduced in late 2000. Failing the passage of the Akaka Bill, now with a great mahalo to President Obama, he has taken the step to recognize that Native Hawaiians should have our own pathway separate from that of the Native Americans and Native Alaskans. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, there was an understanding on most of the part that there was already a pre-existing relationship with the over 200 laws that have been passed by Congress acknowledging Native Hawaiians, the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, which set up certain special lands mm-hmm. for Native Hawaiians to homestead. Even the 1959 Admission Act acknowledges the Native Hawaiians have special rights to the lands that were taken away and turned over to the U.S. government. But that still didn't established clearly for the U.S. Supreme Court in the 2000 Rice versus Caetano decision that there's this relationship has existed. So, and there have been several lawsuits seeking to dismantle the Office of Hawaiian Affairs and the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, and also programs under our Ali'i Trusts for Native Hawaiians as being race-based preference for Native Hawaiians. And so by having this having self-government, our own nation, and having a government-to-government relationship, we will be able to really protect all of these entitlements and the rights that we have as Native Hawaiian people within the framework of U.S. law.
That race-based argument that had been advanced was a pretty potentially quite a destructive one.
Yes, and it remains a threat. Unless we are successful in reestablishing our Native Hawaiian government and establishing that government-to-government relationship, the rights that we have and the entitlements that we have as Native Hawaiian people continue to be vulnerable to civil suits that could dismantle those rights. Mm-hmm. And especially with, you know, as we see a more conservative trend in the United States building with the candidacy of Trump, you know, our rights and our entitlements could very seriously be eroded.
It would seem that ratifying that Constitution would be the next order of business and a very timely one, yeah?
Yes, yes. And I was part of the AHA that drafted a Constitution for a Native Hawaiian nation, and we are seeking to raise our own monies to hold an election that would ratify the Constitution. We have 120,000 Native Hawaiians who are enrolled in, through the Native Hawaiian Roll Commission to participate in the ratification of a constitution. And once we have the money that we seek, about $2 million to run the election, then we will hold a ratification vote.
That $2 million pays for essentially the infrastructure of running an election, right?
Yes.
The polling booths and just the counting mechanism, everything that you
right.
need.
Right, and education of you know, those who are participating in the election.
You need to just get the word out as
yes,
along with
correct.
Everything else. Well, this will obviously be a very interesting story to follow, Deviana. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much
for talking with us. Dr. Deviana Pomaikai McGregor, he's a professor and founding member of the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of Hawaii Manoa. She's a historian of Hawaii and the Pacific, and you can learn more about her and her work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. And in parallel with the quest for self-determination, there's another struggle, simple dignity. Disney has now pulled its Maui the Demigod Halloween costume from shelves after being reminded that brown skin does not a costume make. The costume has been compared to blackface. J. Stanford Parker, a.k.a. Bootsy, is a screenwriter who's been writing film and television stories about African-American subjects for decades. He's a close observer of the way different cultures are portrayed in popular media, and we've asking him to weigh in. Good morning, Bootsy.
Hey, good morning, Chris. How are you?
Pretty good. You've obviously seen how stereotypes are used for comedy or amusement, and you see how they evolved. I mean, it's not that long ago that black people were portrayed as, you know, all kinds of degrading images, right?
True, true.
So what what determines who it's okay to mock at any given time, Bootsy?
Well, that seems to be a product of who the power dynamic, you know, the power who is in control is the one who determines what the images are that we see. And as you know, images are powerful, you know, pictures worth a thousand words, blah, blah, blah. So if a picture's worth a thousand words, how many words is a moving picture worth, you know, you do the math on that. So it's determined by, as has been discussed before, way back in the day, someone, one of the actresses, this is in the 30s or so, was asked, how could she bring herself, the black actress was asked, how could she bring herself to play a maid in a movie? Forget her name.
Hattie McDaniel.
Pardon me?
Hattie McDaniel in...
Hattie McDaniel going with the Wind. So how could you bring yourself to play a maid? And her answer was, I would rather play a maid than be a maid. So in the case of the people who are on the other end of the power dynamic, a lot of times it's about survival. It's about putting food on the table. It's about biting your tongue, sublimating your pride, whatever it is. Survival is the main consideration. Well, not pride or equanimity or equality or those type of things. Those type of things come into the picture once you got a little money in your pocket. You get a little bit, and once you get some in your, you get some food in your belly, then you get a little money in your pocket. You get a little money in the bank, then you can start speaking up.
Well, Bootsy, that evolution to some degree for Black America has happened, right? You no longer have a handkerchief head mammy on the pancake box.
Exactly.
But
and that's, yeah, go ahead.
But what, you know, we were talking on the phone last night about how if you go back maybe 20 years and look at how Japanese people, for example, are portrayed in popular media, you would indeed cringe. And, you know, go back a couple more decades, look at how black people are portrayed. It just seems to be an evolution when one culture rises up and says, leave us alone, Hollywood seems to go and just find another.
Well, yeah, well, you know, it started out, black people were portrayed as buffoons and or cowards, usually both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they spooked, no pun intended.
Right, feats do your stuff.
They spooked at every sound.
Yeah.
You know, like they even turned white in some movies and ran off in a very comedic way.
Mm-hmm.
And then that transitioned into maybe 40s and 50s. Where all of a sudden, black people were the character in a movie that were saints. You know, they were the one; they were the conscience of the, you know, of the movie, as the black guy on Lifeboat. You know, many other movies. Then that evolved into where black people became Avengers. You know, Shaft.
Shaft, yeah.
You know, and so forth. Then that evolved into where black people became villains.
Mm-hmm.
And then that evolved into black people became anybody in a movie.
Yeah.
You know, where there was complete acceptance, but they had to go through, they had to go from, man, I'm not really sure of who I am, to say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that transition was very quick, you know. But it was a statement of being, a statement, I'm here. I'm, you know, like you can't treat me like you've been treating me. And every culture has had to go through that transition.
But Bootsy, here's my question. Wouldn't you think that after offending black people and then moving on to offending Asians and now moving on to offending Polynesians, that that those running popular culture might sort of think, might see a pattern here and decide maybe this isn't a good idea at all.
You would think that they would, but you have to keep in mind that you're dealing with people that deal in self-fulfilling prophecies. If they say a black movie is not going to, we're not going to send a black movie to Europe because it's not going to make money, so they don't send the movie to Europe, and so, of course, it doesn't make money. See, I told you, you know. And so it's the same thing. And if you'll notice the pattern, they pick on whoever has the least amount of political power is the group that gets picked on.
Yeah.
Black people have a lot of political power right now. They can have a hand in deciding an election. You know, Trump would love to have the numbers that Hillary has. If Trump had the numbers that Hillary had, the election would be over.
Well,
and with black people. And then the next group that they attack, I say they, you know, were the Mexicans.
Mm-hmm.
But when they found out the kind of political power that the Mexicans have but hadn't spoken about, when they started speaking out, they kind of backed off of the Mexicans. And so now the Pacific Islanders is just the latest in a long line of what they consider to be people who are weak politically.
Well, I've got a bit of a surprise there, Bootsy, and we've got to leave it there. But thanks very much for weighing in on this. I really appreciate it.
Oh, okay, man. Thank you.
You bet. J. Stanford Parker, a screenwriter known professionally as Bootsy, is the former story editor of the D.L. Hughley Show and a writer on several popular film and television comedies. Today's Backyard Quiz is frighteningly funny. Later in the program, we'll be hearing about a biography of the late great comedy figure, Rap Replinger. And Replinger was well known throughout Hawaii for his live and television comedy performances that took a humorous look at modern culture in Hawaii. Skits such as Room Service and Auntie Marielani's Cooking Show were instant classics that provided quotable lines like, "Not too sweet, not too rancid, and oh, that Russell, what a pest," that were no doubt repeated in many Hawaii households. In addition to his solo work, Rap was known for being part of a local comedy ensemble, and for today's quiz, we want to know, what was the name of that ensemble? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Rumors Nightclub at Ala Moana Hotel, now available for private functions, offering a sound system, four giant projection screens, dance floor, and special menus for Hawaii's nonprofits. AlaMoanaHotel.com.
December 7th marks the 75th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack, which means it's also been three-quarters of a century since many events leading up to our entry into the war and unknown to the public unfolded in the corridors of power. For example, how much did President Roosevelt know about German atrocities against Jews and other so-called Untermenschen? Did FDR know, expect, or welcome the attack on Pearl Harbor? If Hitler hadn't declared war on us, what would Roosevelt do? Arthur Mark Werder's new book, 1941, Fighting the Shadow War, A Divided America in a World War, is a fascinating exploration of America's clandestine involvement before December 7th. And Mark joins us in studio this morning. Aloha, Mark.
Aloha, Bill.
So we don't want to give away the ending. Well, spoiler alert,
Yeah.
So there were 11 months before December 7th, 11 months and a week, and a lot went on. What do you think was the most important thing that went on behind the scenes that the general public didn't know about?
Well, Franklin Roosevelt was very busily trying to get the U.S. into the war in Europe, while at the same time trying to avoid war in the Pacific. And so he set up what was called the Neutrality Patrol. Officially, we were at peace with every nation on Earth. And in fact, we were forbidden to directly aid any warring nation. And so FDR, who believed that it was absolutely vital to our security that Great Britain win the war and that Hitler be defeated, he was sending out our ships into the Atlantic, actively informing the British about the presence of German U-boats. Most Americans weren't aware of just how deep the U.S. became involved in the war, which was actually a war being fought in the shadows.
Well, apparently Radio Berlin and Goebbels were sort of griping about lend-lease and such things to some extent, and I imagine behind the scenes. Was that sort of like, we're not really at war, but we're frenemies? Lend-lease, that was an interesting concept, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, so FDR had this brilliant idea that the Brits, who were flat broke, the Chinese, who were at war with Japan since 1937 and had no effectively no resources to fight against this major war industrial power, he had this idea that the United States should be able to provide weaponry and other materials without actually being paid for it, because this was in our national security interests. Of course, he had to get this through Congress, and Congress was very isolationist, very much opposed to U.S. intervention. He was politically brilliant. He managed with this sort of homely idea of lending a neighbor who's having a fire a garden hose to put out the fire and saying, well, if the fire hose is damaged, you know, get me a new one, and otherwise just return my fire hose to me.
And so those were the four Piper destroyers and other things, sort of, quote, leftovers from World War One. But did they lend them modern stuff as well?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. So the four Pipers, you're talking back to the bases for destroyers deal, which was just about the best deal the United States had made since getting Manhattan for some trinkets and $24. The Brits were in desperate need for additional destroyers to protect their convoys and also to defend the English Channel, because Hitler was planning an invasion of England. And they didn't have sufficient Navy vessels, despite being the world's dominant Navy, to protect these vast areas of oceans. And so the U.S. made a deal that we would get basing rights on some British colonial possessions in return for about 50 ancient destroyers.
And in the meantime, the German ambassador to the United States and the American ambassador to the Third Reich are sort of, we know that you know that you know that we know that we know the whole thing is going on. Icy courtesy.
Yep.
But in the meantime, the Untermensch, the Übermensch, the Third Reich's superior master race concept, how about the atrocities? What did Roosevelt know? And what was the reason he was angling to get into the war?
No. That was not the reason that the U.S. Went to war. So there was, of course, awareness throughout the 30s as Hitler rose to power that he had a racial theory of the Aryan race, the dominant race, and that they should be extending their presence across Europe and dominating both Western Europe and then finding new lands for Aryans to spread into in Eastern Europe. But the idea that that the Jews and other so-called underhumans should be killed, that was something that Americans, by and large, were only beginning to become aware of. The Holocaust itself as a kind of mass industrial killing process didn't really begin until late 1941. I mean, with the invasion of the Soviet Union in June of 1941, there was a beginning of this process of mass murder. But the idea of this horrific genocide of a people wasn't yet known. Even the word genocide hadn't been coined yet.
So it was just something, well, they're not very nice, but if we defeat them, we can take care of this overall Nazi nastiness. I'm just trying to understand the psychology behind this from the perspective of the president.
Yeah. Well, you know, unfortunately, there was a lot of anti-Semitism in the United States itself. And even the State Department, I know from the personal experience of some cousins of mine, they were Polish Jews fleeing the Nazis. They came across the Soviet Union, got the last ship out of Japan to San Francisco, got to San Francisco. These were refugees. They had family in the United States willing to sponsor them, and they had money with them, so they would never have been a burden on anyone. And the State Department had officials who made it very clear they didn't want any Jews coming into the country. And so they were denied visas, and they ended up, after being stuck on without being able to come into the country in San Francisco for a month, they fortunately were able to go to Mexico, where the Polish embassy in exile sponsored them, and they lived there throughout most of the war before finally being able to come into the U.S.
And it goes on and on and on, and through the length of history, I hope that we do not repeat these many mistakes. The research you've done is just absolutely amazing, and I want to thank you so much for being on the show. I wish we had more time, but unfortunately, Mark, we're out of time to talk about it, but I'll certainly hope more people get your book. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Bill.
Mark is an award-winning popular historian, author, and journalist. 1941, Fighting the Shadow War, A Divided America in a World War, is his latest work. His other books, The Millionaire's Unit, The Aristocratic Flyboys Who Fought the Great War and Invented American Air Power, and The Bonfire, The Siege and Burning of Atlanta, have won wide critical praise. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for many more details.
HPR's sustaining members are the heart of this station. They know that their monthly gifts mean a steady, predictable income and that HPR couldn't survive without them. Sustainers are a big part of the reason we can come to you daily, so please take the health and well-being of our radio station seriously and pledge $10 a month to keep your public radio station strong. Keep HPR coming to you every day. Call us at 955-8821 or become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting and Sacred Hearts Academy.
The State Department of Health has been forced to close a Kauai beach that has been the subject for years of complaints about fecal contamination of nearshore waters. It's a serious health threat whose source has not yet been nailed down, and Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair is on hand to tell us more. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris.
It's remarkable to me that the source has not yet been nailed down, yeah?
Yeah, there's actually been complaints about this for some time. In particular, the Surfrider Foundation has been prodding the Department of Health to really find out why these water levels are so unsafe. By the way, we're talking about a beach on the south shore of Kauai. It's where Waiopili Ditch goes into the ocean, dumps into the ocean, mm-hmm. and a lot of people play in that area. And so this is why the Department of Health is going to shut it down for 2 months. They're going to partner with the UC Berkeley lab to try and find out exactly where this fecal matter is coming from.
But it's clearly coming, at least at some part, it's coming through, it's coming from upland, it's coming from the ditch, it's coming from, is this a former plantation area, the land around it?
There is areas around there. There's wells. There are cesspools. These are the kind of things that are going to be tested. They're also going to be looking at decaying leaves. They're going to be looking at sediment and soil. It is, by the way, both animal and human fecal matter that is being examined. Folks that live in the area will still have access, landholders and tenants, they're not going to be turned away, but other folks are not going to be able to go there. You know, it's not just the Surf Rider Foundation that's been pushing for this. The Environmental Protection Agency has also pushed the Department of Health to really do more when it comes to unsafe fecal matter waste, bacteria in the water. So this is something that the DOH is now taking very seriously. The disease, the bacteria itself, can be serious. It can even be life-threatening.
You know, Chad, one thing that we hear about often with stories about public health is the lack of sufficient personnel for monitoring. Mm. There's so many things to monitor, and admittedly, it's a vast and difficult job, but do you think that's part of what's going on here?
There's no question that the Department of Health in recent years has struggled, as have many agencies, to have the proper staffing. I'm thinking about, for example, testing for mosquitoes, right? Mm-hmm. Zika and dengue. And the legislature had to go and fund some extra positions. So certainly that is a concern, is having the adequate staff. And I think by partnering with UC Berkeley, that'll really help to try and get to the bottom of this and find out where exactly this bacteria is coming from, and hopefully return safe waters for people to enjoy there in the South Shore.
No kidding. It does seem like a worthy goal. Thank you so much, Chad.
Thanks, Chris.
And every day we bring you a reality check with Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair. And you're back with the conversation. Just before the news, we talked about water quality concerns on Kauai. And, of course, water quality is a shared concern on Hawaii Island, where the Department of Land and Natural Resources has just heard from the community at a West Hawaii forum. The moderator of the panel was Dr. Bruce Anderson, administrator of the Division of Aquatic Resources in the Department of Land and Natural Resources. Bruce is on the line with us now. Good morning, Bruce.
Morning, Chris.
As moderator, you were in a pretty good position to get an overview of what the concerns are of the community. What comes to mind?
Well, the governor's office sponsored this forum. It was focused on West Hawaii, and the folks who showed up were primarily concerned about existing wastewater disposal system there, and of course had concerns about water quality associated with discharges from cesspools and what was happening at the sewage treatment plant. We had a good panel. We had representatives from the state Department of Health, the wastewater branch and Safe Drinking Water branch. Our Division of Land and Natural Resources had the representatives from the boating division, boating recreation, and the county had a number of representatives from their Department of Environmental Management. So it was really a great chance to hear from the folks involved what was happening as it relates to wastewater management in the West Hawaii area. There was also a professor talking about the basics of wastewater management.
Well, what is it, Bruce, what is it that people want to see done? What's the current state of affairs there?
Well, there were a number of issues that were raised by those participating. Many of them were concerned about the impacts of wastewater disposal associated with the use of a sump, basically. It's a disposal facility adjacent to the plant, basically a hole in the ground where they're discharging about 1.5 million gallons per day of treated wastewater. But the concerns there are that the wastewater is flowing underground into the nearby ocean, Honokahol Harbor is very close to the sump and immediately down gradient. And of course, there are concerns about the impacts on the coral reef in that area and human health. Hawaii has some really unique geology. It's mostly comprised of fractured basalt, and water moves very quickly through the ground. So whenever you put wastewater on the ground, you're worried that it might eventually or very quickly actually get into the ocean. For those who swim in that area, you often feel cold freshwater springs along the shoreline, and that's really fresh water that's moving very rapidly through the ground and out into the ocean. So that raises concerns not only about the current situation, but also about cesspools and septic tanks that have proliferated along the shoreline. There's a community nearby in North Kohala called Pu'uko in Wailea, and they're particularly concerned about the use of cesspools along that strip of shoreline. Homes there are right near the ocean, and the concern is they are impacting the marine life in that area, and their solution is to look at putting in a collector system and constructing a treatment plant, ultimately. But those same problems exist around much of the Big Island, where you have lots of individual wastewater systems very close to the ocean.
Yeah.
And they're obviously posing some risk to the nearshore environment.
Well, that combination of, as you say, fractured basalt and cesspools near the shoreline would almost inevitably lead to some contamination, I would think.
Yes, certainly. You worry about nutrient loading into the ocean. You see evidence of algae on the shoreline, which is often associated with sewage discharges. Basically, a cesspool is a hole in the ground, and raw sewage is going into that hole, and of course, can very easily work its way to the ocean. So in those situations, the real solution is to put sewers in, put in collector systems, and treat the waste, and ideally use it for reuse it for irrigation and for other purposes. This is happening on much of the island. They are making some significant improvements, but you know, we're dealing with decades of growth, and often growth without adequate infrastructure, and this is the result of that.
Is West Hawaii the area of greatest concern on Hawaii Island, from what you describe?
It's not a unique situation. There are lots of cesspools in the Hilo area on the east side, but West Hawaii is unique in the sense that it's probably the fastest growing community in the state, but certainly on the Big Island. It's growing very rapidly, and infrastructure simply hasn't kept up with growth. So you have a lot of homes with individual wastewater systems that have been built, and developments occurred often without having sewer systems in place to handle the wastewater. I would say besides traffic, having adequate wastewater infrastructure is probably the most critical need for communities like this that are dealing with rapid growth.
Well, Bruce, do you feel from the panel last night that the community, that there was consensus, that you got a sort of a consensus from the community of what its concerns were?
Yeah, it was a great chance for all of us to hear from the community. It was a very good group of people, often professionals in the business were there, and actually a good time for agencies to talk to one another. Surprisingly, these opportunities don't come up very much, and I think even the panelists learned a lot about what others were doing, other agencies. I can't remember in over 30 years of dealing with wastewater-related issues a meeting like this where you had everyone getting together to talk about some of the problems.
One thing let me mention
very quickly is the reuse of effluent. The sewage treatment plant that serves Kona, called the Kealkehi sewage treatment plant, is currently treating the water to what they call a secondary level, and again discharging it into a sump. The plan there is to reuse that water. And in fact, there are now wonderful opportunities for doing that. There are a number of parks and other features being developed in the area around the treatment plant at the old Kona Airport, at the Queen Liliuokalani Trust lands nearby, where effluent can be effectively used for irrigation on and.
So that
and,
really deserves to be explored then, Bruce. Thanks very much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, plants being up.
Dr. Bruce Anderson is administrator of the Division of Aquatic Resources in the State of Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources, which is responsible for managing fisheries and aquatic resources throughout the state.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation in support of the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting James Rosenquist's House of Fire, a masterwork of American pop art, on view through October 2nd. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. The first thing you notice about Karen White is her smile. She doesn't look like a retired probation officer, but she is, and she's been helping families since her high school days. Judges often turn to her for sentencing recommendations for youthful offenders. If she said, "He's a good kid," they usually got a break. She says the problem is almost always with the parents, not the kids. So finding better living conditions for her wards became a major goal. She and her husband Bob founded the Ho'omakahō Scholarship for people who've been in trouble and want to turn their lives around. She's been a volunteer for the Hawaii Community Foundation, served on the board of the Oahu Children's Justice Center, was a founding member for Habilitat, and many others. In my quest to understand the benevolent mind, one thing keeps coming up. People like Karen say again and again, "I wish I could do more." Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
We're going to learn about the Rap Rapplinger biography coming up, but first we ask you about Rap's comedy beginnings for the Backyard Quiz. Before his untimely passing in 1984, Rap produced 6 comedy albums and TV specials in just 5 years, and an additional 4 produced posthumously. Rap's style would have been right at home on SNL, which began airing 1 year before his first album. Just Google Rap's Hawaii on YouTube and you'll see what we mean. Now, how did Rap get his start? Well, before his solo career, Rap Rapplinger, James Grant Benton, and Ed Kaahea founded the comedy ensemble trio Booga Booga in 1974. And that's the answer for today's quiz.
And Bill, Michelle Grotstein got up to watch Booga Booga at the Territorial Tavern many times. She's the winner of our quiz. Congratulations, Michelle.
All right. And if you have a quiz you'd like heard, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Tanimitsu, Mitsuyoshi, Yoshimura, Murakami, Kamikawa, Kawamatsu, Matsutaka, Takahashi, Hashimoto, Motooka, Okafune, Funashige, Shigeyasu, Yasutake, Takamine, Minahira, Hirayama, Yamanaka, Nakashima, Shimakuro, Kurosato, Satagata, Gatagona.
That still slays me after all these years. Lisa Clark Stone was Lisa Clark when she lived here in the late 70s and 80s. She was a radio journalist, then an anchor reporter at KITV. She left Hawaii in 1990, anchored CNN Headline News in Atlanta. Now she lives in Nashville and owns a television production company with her husband, Rich. Well, during her Hawaii radio days, she met and later married an amazing guy. And now she's writing his biography, Paradise to Paradise, the Rap Rapplinger story. And she joins us by phone from Tennessee. Aloha, Lisa.
Aloha.
Aloha, Bill. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So, where to start? Well, I guess start at the beginning and find out why you're doing what you're doing now.
Well, it had its beginnings when Phil Arnone and KGMB did what they call a life story on rap in 2011, and that just opened a floodgate of memories. It was kind of like therapy, I guess. In a way, and at the suggestion of a friend, I started journaling my way through that experience. Mm-hmm. And I also started asking a lot of questions that I hadn't asked 32 years ago when rap died. And here on the mainland in my quote-unquote new life, I didn't talk about him much, but whenever it would come up, you know, people, oh, were you married before or whatever?
Yeah.
Always people would say, when I tell them the story of rap, man, that would make a great movie. And so I believe that a story needed to be told in more detail, you know, more than a television documentary could cover. I mean, that said, Phil Arnone and his team did a fabulous job of condensing his life into an hour documentary.
Right.
And I thought they did a great job.
But how do you take just an hour when there's so much more to relate?
And boy, I'm finding that out. It's like that Fix song, one thing leads to another. You know, I talk to
exactly.
one person and then they tell me about someone else. Oh, I've got to talk to that person. And you'd think for somebody who only lived for 33 years that it would be fairly simple, but it's a complex project.
Well, there was another guy from Nazareth that lived a purported 33 years, and his story is pretty complex. Now, there's true. Black holes aren't just for space exploration. You were talking about black holes as a biographer. What do you mean by that?
Well, a black hole is a part of the person's life that you're doing the biography on that you don't have a lot of information. And so I'm working to fill one big black hole is when he was in L.A. for 4 months after leaving Booga Booga, and that's during the time that he wrote the material for Poi Dog, and then John DeMello tells the story of how he called him collect, and then he sent him a plane ticket, and then Rap came home and recorded Poi Dog. But during that time, those 4 months in L.A., not much is known about that. I know that he performed at the Comedy Store and the Improv, but really haven't found anybody to tell me much beyond that. So that's a black hole. And
well, let's put it this way. Are there many, or to put it for a local audience, more black pukas you win feeling?
That's the biggest one, really. I've spent many hours in the library. I love the Honolulu State Library. It's one of my favorite places on earth. And I've spent a lot of, and put a lot of nickels in the machine to make copies. It's so old that it's not digital.
I remember
not online.
A 1974. What was a little local newspaper that used to get free out in front of Cape Way? Oh, it escapes my mind. Well, there was a picture of these young guys, and it said Mokes with Different Strokes when Booga Booga first formed at the Territorial Tavern.
Sunbum.
Yeah, that was it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody has sent me, and people have been really great sending me things, and it's been wonderful, the cooperation that I've gotten from people.
Well, one thing that seemed, he was so incredibly funny when he was on stage and when he was on camera, but in private, he was very intense and very serious about comedy. Isn't that what you found out?
He was intense, but, you know, he was also funny, too.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I'm proud about Rap is that he didn't use four-letter words
right.
in his stage act. And nowadays, you know, pretty much that's kind of a crutch for a lot of comedians. It seems like when things are getting slow, oh, I'll just drop an F-bomb or something, but in private, you know, we had our own jokes, and, you know, that we had the same sense of humor, which was off-color, but that's not something that he did for the public. But yes, he was serious. He was also kind of shy and a loner. I think people would be surprised to know that.
Well, when he did his special Raps Hawaii, it seems that a lot of times he wouldn't really, even though he was very, very tight and scripted for his albums, he would just have a concept, and he liked to just keep going and going and going until something felt right. Was that typical of a lot of other stuff he did?
So much of what he did on Raps Hawaii came from his album material.
Mm-hmm.
But the one skit that you were in, Taste Test, I don't believe, is on any album. And that's one reason I reached out to you. Uh-huh. I mean, you were on my radar. Was you were one of the only people who had dialogue with rap in Raps Hawaii. And, you know, when I showed my kids when I showed them Raps Hawaii, that was one of their favorite.
Yeah, that's it. It was amazing to watch them work because, this, if I can just briefly, when that table broke, that was not planned. That was the last take of the day. And it was just, it was a gift from the comedy gods because it worked so perfectly. I thought he might be injured, but I realized the camera was rolling, so I walked out of frame. And as soon as I was out of frame, I turned around and said, "Are you all right?" And he says, "Oh, that hurts. Help me up." But that's perfect.
And you said, I didn't know this, when you told me when we spoke last night, that that was shot in the same studio where they did the evening news.
That's
and
exactly.
Bob Stevie was, and his producers and news crew were all waiting for you guys to clean up so they could come in and
that's exactly
do their
right.
newscast.
Whatever happened, that had to be the last take of the day. Well, to put it in local vernacular, hey, we can talk story a long time, but unfortunately the limits of time have come up for this particular interview. So I think it's going to be a great work, and he will always be remembered. And, yes, we have a guy here named Russell.
I noticed that. He called me this morning. I was giving him my phone number, and I almost said, "Hey, you got pen?"
He did. Lisa, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me, Billy.
Aloha. Author Lisa Clark Stone is nearing the completion of her biography and memoir, Paradise to Paradise, The Rap Replinger Story. You can find much more information about it on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Tone, the time will be 5:59 and 47 seconds. No, 48 seconds now. 49. Okay, 50 seconds. That's 5:59. Wait, 5:59 and 4 seconds now. Okay, 5, 6, 7 seconds. Okay, 50. Okay, wait. Okay, coming. Okay. 6 o'clock!
Can't follow that, can you, Bill?
Nothing to follow with that.
Really brilliant comedy from Rap Replinger. And that's it for this week. Coming up next week, we talk Aloha shirts with Dale Hope.
Plus, we learn how to party with an infant with author Cowie Hart Hemmings.
And let us hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at the number 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you have comments, you can post them on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. Send Twitter messages to HI Conversation.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information on the Conversation page of the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finiter and Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Bill Sage.
I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday and pick up the conversation.